Hello, I'm Anne Mossop, Sydney Writers Festival Artistic Director. We hope you enjoy this episode from our podcast program.
Well, thank you. Welcome, everybody. We meet today on Gadigal land, part of the Eora Nation, and we pay our respects to the elders, past, present and emerging. And we particularly welcome Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders in the audience today. And we look forward to a positive vote when Australians go to the polls in October this year. Indigenous Australians were not recognised in the Constitution, but they were mentioned. It was said quite specifically that that Indigenous Australians would not be counted in the census, excluded from the population, and it took until 1967 to sort that out. So surely now we can go the extra step in October. So, the panel. Far end, Laura Tingle is political correspondent with 7:30 at the ABC after a long career in newspapers, and she was very recently elected, not appointed, to the ABC board. Nikki Sava is a columnist at the Nine newspapers and author of many books, most recently Bulldozed. And Bulldozed just won the Australian book industry's non-fiction book of the year. And I think given that it traced the three years leading up to the last election, she could have bluffed her way through, entered it in the fiction section. And I think she would have won that as well. And Amy Remikas, a political journalist with The Australian, and just in the last few days, with The Guardian, sorry. If I'm going to get it wrong, I get it really wrong.
A slight difference. We're very similar, though, in editorial direction.
But The Guardian has been, over the last few days, celebrating 10 years in this country, and it's been a remarkable development to the point now where they are a major player in the market. Anthony Albanese and the Labor government have just had 1 year in office, and we will look at that. But I want to start with something that I think really sets this period apart from any other. And that is the dominance that Labor has at the moment, federally and in the states. Only once before have they gone close to this sort of dominance. From 2002 to 2008, there were Labor premiers in every state, including Tasmania. But John Howard was Prime Minister throughout most of that period. So you just had that window in 2007 when Kevin Rudd came in, and then it sort of went south in the states and federally from that point onwards. So, Nikki, I'll start with you. How is it so? What has happened to bring about this situation that exists right now?
Well, two things, I think. One is the decline of the Liberal Party as both a fighting machine and a party that represents mainstream Australia. That doesn't seem to happen anymore. So I think that's had a big influence. But also, I think that there are a lot more choices for people now in the electorate, whether it's to vote for Greens, to vote for Teals, to vote for One Nation even, or to PUP. So it has taken away from the two major parties, and the party which has been able to respond better to those challenges is Labor, and not the Liberal Party. And Labor has done a lot of work in organising its infrastructure. It has very good campaign teams, and it has recruited a lot of good candidates, a lot of diverse candidates. And the Liberals are dysfunctional in their state divisions, and that has affected their ability to attract good candidates. And I think it all sort of flows into one another and has led to a gradual decline in the Liberal Party. And they're no longer, I would think, a forceful entity in federal politics.
Amy, what are your thoughts on that?
Everything Nikki said, but also I think there's been a massive demographic shift in Australia as well. We know from the last census that the boomer generation and the millennial generation were equal, and because of the linear nature of time, millennials have now eclipsed boomers as the most dominant in population demographic in Australia. And that is really important for several reasons. And it's not just because of the old political adage that younger people vote more progressively. It's because when you look at millennials, of which I am one, and Gen Z, there has been economic crisis after economic crisis. There has been massive climate change issues. There has been widening social inequality. And those foundational blocks where you're supposed to be able to buy wealth, like you can get a career, you get wage growth, you can buy a house, you can start a family, that hasn't happened for my generation. We can't buy houses. We haven't had a lot of wage growth in the last 10 years. In fact, we're only at 2012 levels now. So when you take into account inflation, we're still going backwards. When it comes to starting families, you don't have a lot of support, because if you have been lucky to buy a house or even find a rental, you're away from your village, you're away from your families. And so all of that has compounded into younger Australians voting more progressively. And there is nothing in the Liberal Party platform that appeals to younger people, because they don't have that wealth, that individual wealth to protect. They don't care about all of the culture wars that are being waged. They care very muchly that nothing has been done about the climate for the last 10 years. They care very much that nothing has been done about addressing inequality. And the Liberal Party doesn't have any of those answers. They're too busy worrying about T-shirts that bureaucrats are wearing and, you know, whether trans women are allowed to play in sport or not. And, I mean, apart from being abhorrent, that doesn't actually address any of the issues that are happening in Australia. Because when you govern by Sky News and the Oz, you're going to get policies for Sky News and the Oz. And I can tell you from their viewership and readership numbers, that's not enough to win you an election.
Laura, John Howard has said that it's all part of, you know, political cycles work this way. Some of them can be very big cycles. I was 22 before there was a Labor government in my lifetime. That was the 23-year cycle. How do you see this one?
Well, I think that's right, Barry. I mean, I know there have been times when I've written pieces, had discussions about on exactly this sort of topic, only the reverse. You know, the Labor Party's fucked, basically. That's it. out of here. The structures are gone, all those sorts of things. But I think there's a combination of the sorts of things that Nikki and Amy are talking about going on here which make it fundamentally different. One of them is that before you get to the particular qualities of Peter Dutton and the Liberal Party, at the moment, there is this generational change going on. And what's in some ways most remarkable about that is that the coalition is still playing the John Howard game, which is giving lots of stuff to old people, you know, superannuation, you know. Basically, he stacked the decks so that it's okay to raise the age pension, but it's not okay to raise the pension for single mums. You know, all those sorts of inequalities we're seeing was part of the Howard strategy of feeding the base, which was an old base. So, which gets into Amy's territory. At the same time, but both sides of politics have faced this existential crisis in the nature of their organisations. Now, I don't really have any good idea about whether the Labor Party is necessarily, you know, how deep their organisational structure is better than the Liberals. It always looks much better when you've won, but obviously they're getting much better candidates. But I think there are two other things which we haven't raised, and this partly goes to why there's also a dominance at the state level. It's about the nature of the politics that are practiced. if you think about one of the oldest governments, state governments, the Queensland government, how did they get there? All the LNP's own work. Senior moment, bald guy.
Campbell Newman?
Campbell Newman, yes. So
Campbell Newman... Easy to forget him.
Campbell Newman comes in and sort of, he sort of is, you know, incredibly ideological and, you know, has that great confidence he can basically do anything. And turns out you can't. But the sorts of politics that Nikki and Amy have made reference to, you know, they're stuck in this world where they are chasing, and, you know, as I often say, I blame John Howard for everything, but the, you know, perpetual campaigning, going for the 24-hour news cycle, they were things that really came to the fore under Howard, and you can sort of see them, whether it was Abbott, who sort of lifted it to another level, or Dutton now, when they're in a bind, you know, break glass, or it's, which is basically all the time at the moment, but they go back to that model of just the absolute... It's not even politics, it's just sort of noise, you know. So I think that makes it very hard for them to then turn around and say, actually, what's been happening? And I won't go on much longer, but I suppose the other thought I had, which partly comes from what these guys have been saying, is that Labor has been under threat, if you like, from the left, but also from the independents for longer. And in a different way, I mean, the coalition was under threat from One Nation. And what that did was force them back into their base. Whereas Labor has been facing all of these challenges, you know, largely from the Greens, but also from independents as well, which have forced them to both sort of move to the centre and to the left, you know, from a period where they became quite a conservative party, obviously on economic policy, but even on social policy. So in some ways, those demographic changes that Amy's talking about have sort of reinforced the and these party political structures have meant that Labor has had to, in a very sort of upfront fashion, face these threats and change because they might lose their seats, whereas the Libs were still going, oh, how do we keep Pauline Hanson at bay? So I think there'd been a lot of different levels of things going on there.
What's the next step there, Amy, with that Laura's talking about? Because we're now seeing the coalition clearly under threat from the Teals and other independents, and I can't see any of those being reversed at the next election, and then they might even add to them. But what's the equivalent threat to Labor? Because surely at some stage that will happen. And who will they be? Who will emerge that then threatens some of the time servers in those safe Labor seats?
It's really interesting. I mean, just on Laura's point, I think the most telling thing about the Liberal Party not getting it and how to change is the fact that they still wheel out John Howard when they're in trouble in an electorate. And it's just kind of like, why are you bringing Grandpa out? Just let him go sit in front of the cricket. Like, we don't need Grandpa. But with Labor, they have been choosing more dynamic candidates. And I think it was really interesting just before the budget when everyone was pushing Labor to go further on welfare. The people who put their names to it publicly were a lot of the young candidates who had just been elected, and they were publicly signing letters saying, we need to do this. And that's quite courageous for somebody on the backbench who is just starting out their political career, because, like, the number one rule in any workplace is don't piss off the boss, don't embarrass the boss. And that's what they were doing. And that speaks to what Laura was saying about needing to try and hold on to the left. But Labor's long-term project under Anthony Albanese is obviously to keep as much to the centre as possible and make incremental changes that don't scare too much of the people who aren't rusted on, who are swinging voters and who would maybe get freaked out by the left version of Campbell Newman. So you're not putting bikies in pink jumpsuits, but you're giving people more money, which can upset a lot of people in middle Australia. But that means that you're going to lose the people who want to see more done to address inequality in Australia. And that's where the Greens and a lot of the independent progressive candidates come in and really start to threaten Labor's base, even more so than we have seen over the last 10 years. Because if we go to a situation where the Liberal Party keeps on the path that it's on, and there is nothing to say that it's not going to stay on that path for quite a few years, even if Peter Dutton gets toppled, you've got Angus Taylor or Susan Ley or Dan Tehan or Paul Fletcher. So it's not as if, like, you know, there's a young dynamic candidate in there is going to change everything up for them. So if we reach a point where you've got the Liberal Party who are no longer an effective opposition or even an opposition, then the opposition becomes the Greens and the Independents.
But will they be Greens or will they be Greens identifying as Independents?
I think it'll be both. I think that in areas like Queensland, it'll be Greens because they've got a pretty strong branding in Queensland and it'll grow. But I think in other areas, we're going to see more green-aligned independents, not necessarily even teals, like just more, just people who would naturally go to the Greens Party but have decided to go independent because that speaks to more of their electorate. And so then you get a really interesting couple of, like, you know, decades in Australia, because what happens if, you know, Labor is the centre party and then the opposition is a progressive alliance?
Just on the cycle, and I was going through some numbers, and Labor hit rock bottom in terms of the number of MPs that they have in lower houses around the country, state level and federal level. Rock bottom in 2014, when Tony Abbott was Prime Minister. From that point onwards, Labor's increased its numbers every year. They went past the coalition in 2017 with that WA election result. And the numbers today are 346 Labor to 198 the coalition. So that's real dominance. And, Nikki, the next chance to change those numbers doesn't happen until October next year in Queensland and the ACT.
Well, Queensland will be a very interesting election, I think, because of the longevity of Palaszczuk, the fact that she's not travelling as well now as she was before. So the outcome of that will give us quite a few pointers, I think, about what is the possibility for elsewhere and federally. But look, there has been a massive realignment, I think, in the electorate. And yes, the millennials and younger people have moved further to the left and to progressive issues. But I know so many older Liberals who have lost faith in the Liberal Party. And these are more progressive type Liberals who joined when they were in their teens and who look at the Liberal Party now and don't recognise it.
Is it Malcolm Turnbull?
Everybody says that. No, this is, you know, people I know personally who joined the Liberal Party when they were in their teens. They're now in their 40s or in their 70s who could not bring themselves to vote for the Liberal Party in 22 and who went to people like David Pocock, for instance, in the ACT. And I think that that is going to continue. And I think one of the interesting things that was clear from Aston is that Labor is now able to target those kind of once very strong Liberal seats, not in inner areas, but in the outer areas. So that could be a very rich area for Labor to mine at the next election, because you've got seats like Deakin and Menzies and Sturt and Banks. So there is that. And like, I think, like I said before, it's very hard to see where the Liberals are going to go to increase their majority. And certainly there is nothing that is happening in the Liberal Party at the moment that would give you any kind of confidence at all that they're going to move beyond that ultra-conservative wing into the centre where they might actually have a chance of winning those people back.
What if The Voice was to be successful? Would they then think maybe now is the time to change their thinking?
I think if The Voice is not successful, it will be an absolute disaster for the country, but it will probably save Dutton. And by that, I don't mean that he would win the election, but it would certainly probably ensure that he would live to fight another day. So that will give the ultra-conservatives some heart that, yes, they have a constituency out there. But if The Voice is defeated, it will be yes, because a lot of racists will be voting for it, but not everyone, sorry, a lot of racists will be voting against it, but not everyone who votes against it will be a racist. There are a lot of people who are confused about what it will actually mean. And Dutton has been very clever, I think, in playing to that concern. His speech last week about re-racialising, the potential to re-racialise Australia. I'm not quite sure what that meant, but I think I know what it meant. And on one level, you know, it was sounded like he was delivering a warning, but on another level, it sounded like he was giving encouragement. So it was a very sophisticated kind of dog whistle. And I'm a bit concerned that that is going to actually find a home with a lot of people and presents quite a danger. So I think that might work for him unless the yes case really gets its act together.
But Laura, that's the strategy around The Voice. But what is the strategy like in terms of winning government, winning back government? They have to win some of those Teal seats back. They have to win a lot more seats from Labor. What is the strategy? What have you heard from Peter Dutton that suggests that he's got a handle on that?
Nothing. I was doing a podcast with somebody a couple of months ago, and they were saying, I think Peter Dutton's strategy is really clear here, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I said, look, why do we always presume they've got a strategy, you know, on either side? And is that great, was it Mick Young famously said in the Parliament at one stage, you know, I always like to read what Paul Kelly says because I then find out what our strategy was, you know, and it's, you know, we ascribe to people, you know, strategy and cunning plans. And to me, it doesn't look like he's got a cunning plan at all. I think, as I said, he's doing the is trope the right word? I'm not sure. It's modern language, but I mean, he's just doing what he thinks that they've always done. And when people start to say the good thing is it's held the party together, it basically means they don't know where they're going to go next. And
not just people. That's what he says. His greatest success is that he's held the party together.
Yeah, exactly. My point entirely. Yes, the Teal seats, but there are these sort of half memories in politics. One of them is that that Victoria is the heartland of the Liberal Party. Well, somebody was quoting a figure the other day saying they haven't sort of won anything in Victoria except for Julia Banks' seat, I think, since the mid-1990s. You know, this is an urban myth. WA was this absolutely huge stronghold for the Libs forever, and they just got completely wiped out. And not only that, they didn't see it coming. Somebody rang me or texted me while I was sitting on the panel on election night and said, we had no vision on this whatsoever. And that's because the underlying structure is obviously, you know, the organisational structure is bad, but it also, you know, we get a bit fixated about organisational structures, but it means that they don't have anybody who's actually an elected MP or a candidate who's saying, geez, this is going down like a cup of cold sick. You know, they don't really get that it's not working for them. So I don't think he has got a strategy.
Well, let's have a look now at what's gone on over the last 12 months. The title of this discussion is State of the Nation. In the United States, every year the President fronts up for the State of the Union address, and he begins his remarks by saying the State of the Union is whatever, and if you go through the Bushes, Clinton, Obama, even Trump, all use the word strong or some variation on strong. You have to go back to Gerald Ford in 1975 when he stood up and said the state of the nation is not good. And he's the only one who ever conceded that, because he wasn't elected. He took over from Nixon and the Vietnam War had just ended. It wasn't good. But if you were looking at Australia now, Nikki, finish the sentence. The state of the nation is...
teetering between catastrophe and greatness.
You've covered all bases there. You cannot be wrong. Laura.
Troubled and disjointed.
Challenging and depressing.
I would say better than it was.
It absolutely is better than it was politically, because we have, you know, people in the parliament who care again and not just about power, and that's really important. And could I also say thank you to every one of you who have come out again to hear us talk about politics, because it's really easy to get apathetic when you think, you know, like there's been a change and that, you know, we can stand down, because you absolutely cannot stand down. This is a really important period in Australia. But I say challenging and depressing because, yes, politically we do have some hope that there are people in there for the right reasons again, but it's really fucking tough out there, and it's getting harder, and inequality is a huge, huge challenge. We're not doing enough on the climate. And without some sort of groundswell of you can't just hold the line, you have to go further, we could teeter into another lost decade.
That does bring us to Anthony Albanese's performance.
Can we, just before we do that, Barry?
Yes.
I'd like to expand on mine.
There's plenty
of
room there for
expansion. We made it 30 minutes before we took over the conversation. Sorry.
Laura, first.
So I said troubled and disjointed. We do tend to focus, you know, in discussions like this on the state of the parties, but, you know, there are a couple of things about this. One of them is, and Amy's saying it's great that everybody's still interested. Well, actually, most people aren't interested, having been focusing on disengagement with news and disengagement with news because people are sick of hearing about politics. You know, this is an issue, but that doesn't change the fact that there are these underlying issues which I think have sort of snuck up on politics. You know, inequality being the most obvious ones, and inequality intergenerational, inequality in terms of income across the board. We are a different country to the one we were 20 years ago, and certainly a very different country to the one we were 40 years ago when I started in journalism. And I think we just presume that it'll all be fine, and I'm not suggesting there's going to be a revolution and all that sort of stuff, but...
I'd like that.
Bloody Guardian. But I mean... But I think that, you know, the sort of sense of consensus of our society is really troubled, and I think this is something that requires a step up in leadership. So,
Nikki.
So, Dutton's survival strategy relies on him destroying the referendum, on the economy crashing into depression or recession, and bigotry rising. So, you know, that's the disaster side of things. But if we say yes to the referendum, I just think that is the most defining moment for Australia this year. And if we say yes, then I think it will be a great moment. If we manage to survive a recession in spite of everything, that too is going to be a great moment, because all those things about inequality and poverty and whatever will not worsen, but hopefully get better. And it will also put the lie to Australians being xenophobic and bigots. And of course, there are people like that here. But I like to think overall that Australians are much better than that. And so we have the potential to be a great country.
On Albanese's style, I think it was Michelle Grattan who wrote recently that it's softly, softly, catchy monkey. Right? That's the way that he operates. That, and he said himself a few weeks ago that the first term is about establishing the character of the government. And you can see what they're trying to do. They had to restore some integrity. They want to improve their economic credentials. They want to win the trust of the country. What that kind of implies, though, doesn't it, Amy, is that once they've done that and they've established the character of the government, then they'll do real things around the rental crisis, the housing crisis, the student debts and the rest of it. Can you really see that? Because my experience is with so many, I've seen the popular ones and the unpopular prime ministers, and they build up all these credits, political credits. They don't spend it.
No, they don't. And that is the danger. I think that there were a lot of people who had hope and expectation that a Labor government would change the country pretty quickly and work to change the country very quickly. And the hard thing about that politically is that they haven't, and that leads to disappointment in people who then begin looking elsewhere for people who will do that. But then again, like as Laura and Nikki have said, we do keep talking about like politics, and that's our job. But there is also a pretty big disconnect, I think, at the moment between the political class and what is happening on the ground. And Anthony Albanese does have a long-term project, and we know that not just from him but from Jim Chalmers and the essay that he wrote about, you know, doing things in a better way and setting up a well-being budget and trying to do what you can when you can. But as Labor governments tend to do, they come into power at a time when things are pretty messy economically. Like, that's pretty much been the story of Labor governments in this country. You know, you get elected, there's a Great Depression. You get elected, there's a, you know, global financial crisis. You get elected, we're in the middle of, like, a bigger economic crisis than the global financial crisis. And when you look at what is happening in people's lives at the moment, and I know I talk about young people, but this is also happening particularly for women who are older, who may not necessarily have reached the pension age yet, but are renting because they haven't been able to secure housing, and you cannot retire comfortably or even above the poverty line in this country unless you own a house. And there is a really big cohort, particularly of women, because of divorce, death, caring responsibilities, you name it, who don't have the luxury of a house. And so what we've got is a bunch of people who are working but are on Facebook groups saying, I don't have food for my kids this week, where is a food bank? Where you have older people who are working but living in cars and tents. And you keep hearing from the government, we're doing what we can when we can, but that is not changing your situation materially. And I understand that, yes, in a time of inflation, you can't throw in extra money into the economy, but we never try anything different. And this government does not have the political courage to begin trying something different. We can't have a grown-up tax conversation in this country, because the moment that you start talking about, you know, super profit taxes and all the rest of it, you get the business industry saying, this is going to destroy the nation, we're going to all pack up shop, and you get a bunch of people go, oh, that's probably true, and then you get the wobbles. We can't have a conversation about capital gains, because then you'll get, you know, the conservative press starting to talk about mum and dad investors and all of those millions of nurses and police officers who own 80 investment properties and what's going to happen to their retirement plans. We cannot move forward in this country, even with a government that wants to change the nation for good, until we can start having grown-up conversations about how we change things. Because what we've been doing for the last 40 years, the wheels are falling off. It's fucked. It's broken. It's done. And unless we actually start to change how we've done things, that means tax, that means climate, that means actually starting to lift people up and stopping saying, oh, the market will decide these things. Until we start to go, this isn't working, we are not going to see the change that we want in our politicians, because the only thing that moves politicians is you.
The next big test, by the way, well done, well said. The next big test, Laura, around that is the next round of tax cuts. How can you see that developing? Is it, have they got a long-term strategy on that, that they will take something else to the next election so that they cannot then be accused of breaking a promise?
Look, I suppose I'd start by slightly disagreeing with Amy about what's driving the tax discussion now, because I think it's been morphing. I think it's certainly been true that they've been scared of any opposition to things, but I think this factor that we've talked about, which is Albanese's, it's not conservatism, but his absolute determination to establish a track record of trust, you know, before the budget, I was going through and sort of saying, OK, well, what have they done up until now? And I was looking at his address in reply to the budget last year, to the whoever the Treasurer was last year. You know, and you go through and go, tick, tick, they've actually done all this stuff that they said they would do. But they sort of did that in the first 6 or 7 months, and then this year it's moved into this new phase, which to me feels much more sort of conservative in a way. On tax cuts, my working presumption has always been that we would get close to the next election and they would say, OK, we said we wouldn't change the Stage 3 tax cuts and we haven't, but we're actually going to have to do something. So we are going to the election and saying we're going to do something a bit different, you know, which isn't, you know, they put the Stage 3 tax cuts in and a lot of the Stage 3 tax cuts, you can actually argue, are a good idea. Some of it isn't a good idea. But my working presumption is that they would basically talk about a modified version of them at some point. But the indications are, at the moment, that the Prime Minister regards the Stage 3 tax cuts in that camp of, I have to be trustworthy. We said we'd deliver them, so we will. So, therefore, they won't change them. But that means that they will have to take to the next election a really radical tax agenda, which they won't. They'll take a sort of slightly factiony radical agenda. But we interviewed Ken Henry on 7:30 a couple of months ago, and he was just saying, look, if you look at the whole, which I think is $50 billion a year, they've just done this, you know, pretty piss-weak little super change. We'd need about 50 of those to actually address the budget bottom line problem. And it isn't necessarily just about tax cuts, it's about tax bases. It's about doing things like having a gadget in your car that is always telling the revenue department where you're driving, so you're not paying existing petrol excise or something. You know, it's a really radical overhaul of the sorts of things that Henry and his colleagues talked about in their review. But I think that overwhelming factor now isn't quite so much their terror of News Limited, which it was in the Gillard years. It's not even the terror of business, because the business community, say on climate change, they've suddenly gone, actually, we sort of stuffed it up there, you know. And people in the resources sector, I was talking to a CEO in the resources sector a couple of weeks ago, and he said, well, look, actually, we've completely lost our social licence, so, you know, we know that we need to change the tax base. So I think that's sort of a bit of an understated change in the thing, but that means that Labor should be seeing the opportunity they've got to actually cut through and do something a little bit bold.
Hmm. I think they... Can I just add something there too? Well, from my understanding of the way things are going, they will change the Stage 3 tax cuts. They will deliver a substantial proportion of that, because some of them are for lower-end income earners, but they will change it for the top end, and they will redistribute and will have some reforms, but they will take them to an election because Albanese's thing about rebuilding trust is central to his re-election also. So I could see them in the next budget saying, yeah, well, this is what we're going to do, this is how we're going to rearrange and reform, but you get to vote on them. And I think that would be a much cleverer way to go about it rather than saying now, yeah, we're changing everything and yeah. You can like it or lump it.
When you're looking at a report card, the issues identified by the Teals, I think, are worth going to because they proved just how much people care about those issues around climate change, integrity, cultural gender issues. On the integrity issue, there is a National Integrity Commission. It didn't go as far as Helen Haynes's model, for example, but it's there. But on climate change, Amy, there's legislation introduced last year. Still the 43% target into the middle distance. Can they be doing more?
Yeah, they absolutely can be doing more. I mean, we know from the science that what they're doing doesn't even scratch the surface of what we need to do. And I think the safeguard legislation was a safe policy for them because it's something without being everything and doesn't upset the apple cart too much. But I think that as the next couple of years particularly go on, they will just be pushed to do more on climate, not just domestically, but because what our international allies expect us to do as well. It'll become a trade issue if we don't actually start acting on it. And just everything that Nikki and Laura have been saying about who's going to be challenging Labor at the next election, the climate is still going to be absolutely up there because we're about to be in a pretty tough time in the climate with what is coming. And, you know, that's going to bring more natural disasters, and there's nothing like a massive bushfire or a giant flood to mobilise people into saying that their government actually needs to act.
And there's this notion that gas is still in transition. Is that acceptable, and for how long?
That is really tough because both sides are in support of gas and everyone is just kind of thinking, oh, yeah, we do need gas as a transition fuel. But the fact of the matter is that we don't actually need to open up any more gas mines in Australia. We've got plenty of gas already. The problem is that we, you know, have privatised it essentially, and we've allowed companies to take it and sell it for massive, massive profits. They were making profits when it was, you know, at $6, and now that it's upwards of $22, they are absolutely just laughing at all of us. And I think that you will start to see more renewables come on very quickly. We've already got those in train. The good thing about the safeguards legislation is you will actually see some more investment in there. We saw Mike Cannon-Brookes beat out Twiggy Forest, and that's good things too for Australia in terms of project direction and integrity around those projects as well. And I think that as more people see that renewables aren't going to mean that the sky falls in, you're going to see people want to move away from gas.
And foreign policy, we should mention, it is important because according to the experts in Nine newspapers, war with China is 3 years away. In fact, 2 years and 9 months now, because that was 3 months ago. And Laura, the same newspaper called for conscription in peacetime, which was an
What's
interesting
going
call.
On?
You're asking the wrong person. I don't know what's happening there. But how would you judge Penny Wong's handling of the relationship with China?
Look, I think she has done a lot of work to put it back on a sort of more balanced footing, and I think she's done a lot of really good work in the region. I think she's done a little bit more than just having leis put around her neck. but I think there is nonetheless a slight disconnect between what she's been doing diplomatically and the party they've been having over in defence, which I think really, you know, dominates the message that we're sending out to the world. And it's a great big black hole. And I think it could be one of those causes of regret for the Prime Minister and Labor, because essentially, you know, no dollar that ever goes into the defence budget ever comes out alive and never gets accounted for. And no politician ever wants to be the one who says, you know, like if your chief of defence force or whoever says, well, you know, the country will all die unless you spend this money, they're not going to be the ones who say, OK, we'll spend it. So I think, unfortunately, we've become hostage to this AUKUS project without knowing what on earth it's about. And I think that sort of overwhelms any good work that Penny Wong's done.
Just on AUKUS, there's a UK in there. This is about regional security. Why are the letters UK?
Because it's an industry policy. You know, this is about finding jobs for people in Hull or wherever it is. Well, that's a boat. Paul Keating is right in this. It's about giving jobs to the US and UK defence industries. And, you know, if you look at what it was announced when Morrison originally announced, it was all about jobs in Australia and, you know, and sovereign capability in Australia. Well, that sort of just quietly slunk off the list. And I think in all the absolutely, frankly, disgracefully fawning coverage of this issue across the media, nobody has really taken the government to task about how that happened.
Yeah, and the same with the submarine deal, like $360 billion or whatever. The media tends not to chase issues where there's unanimity among the major parties. They just can't see the point if it's not a political issue between the two major parties.
There's a bit of biffo.
Yeah, it just seems to me that this could be the biggest blunder of any government in a long time.
We don't know, because we don't actually know what it is. We still don't know what submarines we're getting and when. At this stage, all we can be sure of is we're going to have one submarine that's going to be going around the South China Sea, you know. That'll stop the
isn't
Chinese.
Isn't it incredible that, you know, the Coalition have no questions about this, despite, you know, there's no confusion, but on The Voice, oh, my God, what could happen? So many questions. How could you sign up without knowing the answer to absolutely everything? But, you know, it's AUKUS, $360 billion on submarines. Yeah. Sounds good. Let's just, you know.
Why did it happen? Did it happen too early in the political cycle? It was so soon after they were elected and they just felt they had no choice.
Well, it had been done before they were elected.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was a decision taken, OK, we don't want any daylight between us and the Coalition. You know, the two big issues, and people in the government will say quite openly about this, look, our two big vulnerabilities politically were national security and economic management. And I had this conversation with a couple of people the day of the budget, and they're saying, well, we've nailed both of those now. That, to me, my critique of Labor on AUKUS and the submarine deal is they did actually have an opportunity to just give themselves some wriggle room, to just tweak it a little bit, and it was just, we're just buying it holus bolus.
But it's hard when Scott Morrison and all five of his ministries signed that piece of paper.
Can we turn the house lights up now so that we can set up microphones and we'll take three or four questions before we finish up. There'll be one here and one over there. And we're also, of course, as was mentioned, we're broadcasting into so many libraries right around Australia, and we'll try and take a couple of their questions as well. And the first one, while we're setting up here, from Wagga Wagga in New South Wales, isn't part of the Coalition's problem that they haven't yet realised that they lost the last election and are, in fact, in opposition? Nikki.
Well, I think one of the really grave miscalculations that they made after the election was that with Morrison out of the leadership, that people would naturally drift back to the Liberal Party. So they didn't really lose because of what the Liberal Party had become. It was all Scott Morrison's fault. Yeah, well, he did share a lot of the blame for that, but it wasn't all about him. And the unfortunate thing is that since then, they have done absolutely nothing to change what was there before, and they haven't listened to anything that the voters have said about what went wrong They think that they can just somehow drift in off the back of economic disaster or voice disasters or whatever, and things will just go back to the normal state of things where the Liberals rule. But I don't think they've realised that the world has changed a lot since then.
Mm-hmm. Can I just say something random about stuff, just because, you know, you're all failing as questioners, so, you know. We've talked a bit about the voice along the way and various views have been expressed. We've talked about what would be bad or good if the voice went down for the politicians and for the country, but I suppose I would just want to make the observation that what worries me about where this is going is that it seems like the Yes case want to say that it's not frightening because it won't do anything, but it's really important because it will. And both of these things probably pragmatically are true, but they're going to have to find a more persuasive argument than that. And I think it is going... I mean, Anthony Albanese, to his credit, has put a huge amount of political capital into this issue, and that's great, but I don't think we've yet seen him or anybody else in Labor actually just cutting through and making the case for why, as a country, we have to do this.
It's a question here from, is that the Mullaney Community Centre in Queensland?
Mullaney.
The Mullaney Community Centre in Queensland. Do you think that the Integrity Commission will actually bring politicians to account? Thinking robo-debt, obviously. I mean, do you think that will... clearly, it's pointing towards referrals, at
yes.
the very least.
And I think what's very interesting there is that the Robo-Debt Royal Commissioner asked for an extra week extension in handing down her report because that would bring it under the auspice of the National Integrity Commission. Mm. It is due to come in from the extension on the 1st. She's asked for it to come in on the 7th of June. And if I was a recently retired MP who had some carriage of robo-debt, I would be quite worried about what that report would be saying and potentially what that would mean in terms of referrals. If I was a recently retired MP who had something to do with grant funding or who perhaps had been sharing information with the private sector from different email addresses or so, I would also maybe be worried about what, just as hypothetical, of course, of what the National Integrity Commission would be looking at. But the thing is we're probably not going to know all that we need to know about what the National Integrity Commission is looking as because, as Laura and Nikki have laid out, Labor did capitulate to the opposition in giving them their private hearings, which means it's not going to be all played out in public. But I think that there's quite a few people sitting around thinking, holy shit, someone's actually going to be looking at us.
Question.
Thanks very much. So many questions I've got, but can only ask one, I guess,
only
Barry.
One.
So back in 2007, Kevin Rudd was very nice with... he had a majority in Parliament, but he was very nice to the independents, and they actually paid off handsomely several years later. Albo's not been quite so nice to the Teals, and I was wondering whether you think that might be a mistake come the next election, given what's happening to the bases of both major parties.
Yeah, it's a good question. And, of course, the first thing he did was to take staff away from the independents. It wasn't a great start in terms of the relationship.
Look, it wasn't a great start. I think, ultimately, that's ended up being a little bit overstated because there was this whole issue of the fact that they'd sort of snuck in all these extra staff to a couple of crossbenches offices, and there has been a bit of a subsequent readjustment. My sort of sense from the independents is that they basically feel like they're having a respectful relationship with the Teals. I think, you know, it's... Mm-hmm. And I would sort of say that the understated element of the Gillard government was that Albanese ran that parliament and he's good at that. So I think it's okay.
And here?
I think, like everybody, I think it's really important that the voice wins. And if you were all individually asked what advice you'd give the Yes campaign, what would that be?
Get your act together.
Well, there is no one actually running the Yes campaign. I think it's too disparate. There are too many different personalities. We know that there are tensions between the various camps, and I think it is essential that they appoint immediately a single campaign director, and that is someone who has had experience in running election campaigns, because this is what it is, and it needs someone with the authority and the experience to be in that job, saying to all of these very interesting but very independent people, these are the messages that we want to get out, and this is how we want them to get out. And you can't just go on Radio National whenever you feel like it and pour shit all over someone who offers a different view, which is what happened a couple of weeks ago, and which I think was incredibly damaging for the Yes case. So I think there needs to be a lot more control exercised about how the way the campaign is actually run and what the messages are that they are going to give to Australians to say, this is why it's important to vote for this. And not because that guy is a bedwetter, you know, and he's wrong, but this is why he was wrong. So I think it needs to be better organised.
Sorry, Nikki, but yes, can we just very quickly take 60-second question? We've got two more, right? One here and then one there.
I think it was Amy who spoke a bit about the greater opposition being posed to a Labor government moving to more towards the centre is for Greens and more progressive candidates. But how do you see that playing out with the two-party system that we have if we've got such a, I don't know, not really much of an opposition in the Liberals and Coalition?
We've seen it work in minority governments. The 43rd Parliament is a great example of that. They didn't lose a single vote on the floor during the 43rd government, and that's not something that Scott Morrison could say despite having a majority. And so I think that's how it plays out.
We're out of time, but we'll take one more question.
Thank you. So full disclosure, I used to be a political reporter for the ABC. I'm Uma Patel. We haven't had a chance to talk about Stan Grant yet, and I was wondering if, Laura, we could get your thoughts. I'm really curious, and also the rest of the panel. And Barry, I know there was an article in Junkie a few years back that looked at the political or the commentators that got to speak on Insiders, and that there weren't any non-white commentators to their knowledge for at least 3 years. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that. And yeah.
Okay, so I'm saying this, you know, as a ABC employee, not as a member of the board. And I'd also say I've been a bit out of the loop because my mother's just died, and I've just been off the radar for the last couple of weeks, which I'm not saying it's a sympathy thing, but I feel bad that I wasn't there when all this was happening. Obviously, what's happened to Stan is really dreadful, really, really dreadful. To me, the issue here is a cultural issue for the ABC, and it's not about necessarily diversity, whether it's racism or any other form of diversity, though that's something that I think, you know, the ABC is trying to address. The issue is our charter says we have to provide and reflect a diversity of opinions about the Australian community, not one opinion. And that's what we do, and that's what we should do, and that's what they were doing on the day of the coronation coverage. I think the treatment, you know, everybody's been talking about social media. The treatment of Stan Grant by other media was fucking disgraceful. And I think that the ABC just really needs to just go, actually, our charter says we do provide a diversity of opinions, and that's what we're doing. So just cop it. And that's what's sort of coming out now, but it's been too slow.
And just further to the other part of your question, you're absolutely identified, mistakes are made with programs, and you identified one of the key mistakes that I think I made and others, the producers of the program for 18 years that I was there. the makeup of the panel. We couldn't identify a senior Indigenous journalist in the press gallery for all that period, and that's where we tended to draw our panel from. But we have made lots of mistakes with the panel, and we continue to make them. But thank you for coming along this morning. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe and to rate our channel.